Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist of Freedom of Faith. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Preston Washington. And thank you for joining us here on the Gist of Freedom by way of www.blackhistoryblog.com. I'll be your host. Joining me tonight will be Donnell Conley, in addition to Penny Marshall, who is the chairperson for the Harriet Tubman Journey there in the state of Delaware, where they're having a celebration. Culminates on March the 10th. Welcome, Penny. Are you there?
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to talk about this event and talk about Harriet Tubman.
Okay, and Donnell Conley, are you with us? Okay. I want to remind folks that we will have a reading of Benjamin Quarles' book, The Black Abolitionist, following our interview with Ms. Marshall. So, Ms. Marshall, bring us up to date. What's going on in the state of Delaware?
Well, what has happened is, your listeners probably may know, it's the 100-year anniversary of Harriet Tubman's death. And Delaware was one of the states that she traveled through towards freedom, not only for herself, but also for others that she carried along with her. So to celebrate the fact that she was able to do this and be an inspiration to so many people, we have decided to travel along some of the areas that Harriet Tubman traveled in Delaware. There's a whole 97-mile trek. But we kind of figured out that we probably would not get enough people to make that distance, and civilization, it's made it difficult. So what we've done is kind of divided into three parts.
Okay.
We have a relay run, a running relay that will occur from Maryland Line, a place called Sandtown, up to an area called Brecknock Park. It's a 14-mile trek in which we will have Delaware State students, students from Wesley College, and also Dover High School students will run that area. That particular program will be started off by the president of Delaware State College, who's been very supportive of this particular venture. In addition, up north, we will have a group of predominantly lady motorcyclists who will come from Pennsylvania and travel down from the north to the Riverfront Park. At the park, we will have a massive group of people that will run around the area that is actually Dravo Plaza, but it's right near the Tubman Garrett Park. The purpose of these events is to kind of enlighten people, educate people about Harriet Tubman, because all the programs, all of the run walks will also have programs in which we talk about Harriet Tubman. We'll have reenactors. We'll also have music that would be important to the time period. And special treat, we'll have some students who have written essays about what if Harriet Tubman had a cell phone and a laptop computer. In addition, we'll have poetry, and we also have history cards that we'll be passing out to folks to kind of keep them abreast of the abolitionists of the time period. So we have a little bit of something for everyone.
Okay. I want to remind our listeners that the Gifts of Freedom will be broadcasting live from those events in Delaware.
Wonderful. We'll be very glad to have you. I would also add that that the events are very children friendly, and that we will have the Children's Museum up north will open its doors at a reduced rate. You can get in if you have a shirt registration for $5, and you'll be able to go in with your kids and make a quilt that would be consistent with telling the story of Harriet Tubman. We've also gotten permission to use a Harriet Tubman coloring book, so we'll have kids that will be able to color the history of Harriet Tubman. You know, the genesis of this whole thing was to make sure that Delawareans and beyond recognized just what a fantastic woman this individual was. Harriet Tubman has been a personal inspiration for me. And many people will read maybe a little bit about her or know a little bit about her, but we wanted it to be more broad spectrum range where folks would celebrate just how much she accomplished.
Yes, she, along with other abolitionists, and our listeners are reminded that we will be listening to the reading of the Benjamin Quarles book, The Black Abolitionist. Will any of Ms. Tubman's descendants be involved in the celebration?
We have. We should have done a better job of getting them involved. We're hoping they will come down and join us. Some people have tried to reach out, and I'm not sure we have someone there, but if they're listening, I hope they will certainly come because of how much she means to all of us. We have access. I mean, if they want to get in touch with me or listening, then they could do so. We have a HarrietTubmanJourney.org website, and then we also have Harriet Tubman Journey Facebook. And you may also call me at 514-7785. So we'd be very happy to have them involved.
What's the area? Go to your phone number.
302, sorry.
302.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Your point about other abolitionists, I mean, what's so important about Harriet Tubman is that she was helped not only by Quakers and good white folks that believed it was important to free slaves, but there was a number of free blacks that had a role in making sure that she made it to freedom, as well as other abolitionists. I believe that sometimes the story gets lost that there were these other black abolitionists that had such a role in the Underground Railroad and in securing the freedom of other slaves. Samuel Burris, for example, is one of those individuals. He's one of the Delaware's most notable conductors on the Underground Railroad, and he was willing to be sentenced to jail, fined, and was almost sold. These folks were just, I mean, they were serious about their mission. And you know, the thing that hits home to me is the hearts of these folks that were involved in this Underground Railroad, Harriet Tubman and the others. They got to know each other. They knew who they could trust and who they couldn't. And somehow they were miraculously successful in taking people from down south and away from what they call bloodhounds, the folks that would be after them, to be able to get folks to freedom.
And William Steele was one of the financiers of the Underground Railroad.
Exactly. Yes, and, he certainly was.
He was the author of the book, The Underground Railroad?
Yes, yes.
How did you get involved in this? What's your background?
Well, I'm a lawyer by trade, and, you know, I went through desegregation. I went through the period of time where much of our history was not very much known to us. My parents did have the requisite Negro pictorial in the basement, but in school I didn't learn very much. But Harriet Tubman was someone I did hear about, and she's kind of stuck with me throughout my life to be an inspiration. And I have a number of, I try to work with a number of charities, and I saw the anniversary of her death as a time that had to be celebrated. And I also, in the same way that she went back over and over again, I thought this was important to do something that gave back to the community. So the proceeds of our event, the race registrations, and also we have sponsors, a number of sponsors that have supported us, we are going to take any money over and above expenses and give it back to a number of charities, many of which deal with children. Weston Neighborhood House, Delaware Futures, the Kinney Foundation, which is connected to ShopRite, which is a primary sponsor of our program, the Inner City Cultural League, which is located in Dover, and I think I'm missing one of them. But we've tried to make sure that we make a positive impact on our Delaware Center for Justice. They're also a very important charity that we are supporting, and we're also helping continue the message of the Byway through an organization that's scheduled to work on keeping that going. But, the message here is that Harriet Tubman was so brave and so willing to give of herself, so why shouldn't we celebrate her, and also why shouldn't we be able to be the best we can be and advance our own interests?
Exactly. You mentioned Samuel Burris earlier.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
He was a black man, is that correct?
Yes, he's very much a black man who the picture of him has him with a very handsome top hat that he often wore. But he worked very hard to make sure that he would not, that he could help other folks. He ended up later on moving to San Francisco and raising money to support people that were free later in his life. But it was interesting just how far he would go. He got sentenced, et cetera, and was almost sold. But then someone was able to pose as a slave purchaser and sort of get him out of the hot seat. And so instead of being sold off to slavery again, he was able to continue his mission. You know, one of the interesting things about Harriet Tubman is that there were not, you know, women back then were not in a position of sort of being at the forefront of things, but she was a woman, black or white, who was so strong that she was able to be at the forefront of things. And you can imagine this 5-foot-tall woman who had been hit in the head and could fall asleep at any given moment, leading grown men to slavery and telling them, you know, you either go forward or, you know, you won't make it.
Did John Brown have any involvement with...
Yes. They knew each other,
right,
and knew each other's work. And in fact, there was a time where they were going to, the mission that he attempted to complete, she was going to be there and help out, but she ended up being ill. But they were certainly respected each other and had a strong relationship.
And you mentioned the Byway. What is the Byway?
in we have in our country a number of byways, of course, but the Harriet Tubman byway in Delaware attempts to track the route that she traveled in Delaware towards freedom and other abolitionists. And there has been a corridor management report that the state has supported that identifies many of the places that are believed to be stops for those that traveled the Underground Railroad. In fact, this month, the final report was unveiled. It was unveiled at the time that our governor determined that we should have a Harriet Tubman Day, which is March 10th, 2013. And it's an interesting work. It's a quite a big book, and it's 200 and some pages, and it identifies the statutes that have been created. It identifies some of the churches that were involved. Some of these places are no longer existing, but actually some of them are. And so it's more than, I guess it's more than just sort of historical buildings. It's a sort of trek that shows the areas that she might have traveled through. And in fact, I went riding on parts of the byway, the 97-mile trek, and you almost can kind of move yourself into the time period, and you can feel the emotion of her having to travel through marshes and very difficult terrain to try to make it to freedom.
I see. And will we be able to buy that book come Sunday?
We don't have that book available, but the best thing to do is to go online and look for the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Byway, the Corridor Management Plan. If you look online, there is a copy that is online, and I think if you contacted the Underground Railroad Coalition, they could assist you, or else actually our transportation department, DLDOT, will help you with having access to that book. But it does have a number of details about places that you can find out information about where Harriet Tubman might have traveled and other Underground Railroad persons.
Were you involved with the byway, and if not, who brought that project about?
I was not. And in fact, I was at an event recently and found out that members from Delaware State College had a role from the beginning, and then our transportation department was given the task of having some folks get together to start the byway and have it succeed. It's not there are certain levels of byways in terms of national recognition, and our byway is still working on some of the signage, but it has come a long way, and the book identifies so many important historical places. There's pages of folks that have, you know, that have been involved in the whole process: the Historical Society, University of Delaware, Delaware State, the Department of Transportation, some of the towns, historians. It's just pages and pages of folks that have become involved.
And the Delaware Historical Societies, are they involved at all?
Yes, they are. The Delaware Historical Societies have been involved. And they've been involved in a lot of the events that have occurred this week in support of Harriet Tubman. There have been, we had 10 days of events, and in fact our walk-run-ride events are sort of a culmination of the events that have transpired. We have had plays, we've had history tours, we've had book readings, et cetera, in the state, all to pay attention and have people pay attention to this important figure in our history.
And how did the Harriet Tubman Day come about? Whose idea was it?
Well, actually, I guess it was mine. It started as mine. I was noticing the date, and I had decided that what should happen is myself and some friends should run the 97 miles. And I didn't have a long list of people that said that they would accompany me. So I noticed the report, the management plan, and I went to see the Underground Railroad Coalition, Deborah Martin, who's located in our government offices, and spoke to her about my idea, and she invited me to the meetings of the personnel that were working on the events for the centennial. And I talked to them about their idea, and an individual by the name of Ann Gravatt with our Delaware Transportation Department talked to me, and we kind of figured out a way to do this without being able to do the whole way, because we figured out it was time sensitive and, as I mentioned before, the terrain. So kind of picked portions that we could use. And as I talked to people, I mean, I won't take credit for the whole thing, because as I talked to folks and I got a committee together, we have some very talented people that have helped out on this committee, and they're all volunteers from all kinds of professions, have sort of added ideas. I mean, we even, in our adventure, we have this coloring book for kids, and that came because somebody suggested that would be a good idea. So we've kind of, the journey itself, as we call it, the Harriet Tubman journey, is a collaboration of just volunteers who Harriet Tubman meant so much to.
Did you meet with the governor on this?
We did not, but he's been very supportive. And, in fact, on the first day of the 10 days, I saw him. I'm familiar with him, know him. And he in our old state house, which is also significant to the Underground Railroad, he came and read a proclamation from the governor's office. He's been supportive, as well as, in fact, we've had a number of our cities throughout the state that have read proclamations. Indeed, the mayors from Dover and Camden will be reading proclamations on Sunday at Brecknock Park, which is the sort of focal point after Sandtown in Kent County. At 12 noon, there'll be a gathering of folks that will wait for the relay team to come up, walk the park, and then they will have a program, and that program will include proclamations. Delaware City, I think, has also done a proclamation. I just today left the Wilmington City Council, who read a proclamation supporting Harriet Tubman Day. So it's kind of just taken off. There are so many people that just love this woman and who just are inspired by what she was able to accomplish.
In our book reading tonight, we're going to hear how the abolitionists back in the day bombarded the State House with petitions. In your efforts in putting this Harriet Tubman Day together, did you use any petitions?
We did not use petitions. I did a lot of letter writing. I did a lot of talks with folks, but we did not use petitions. I guess that would have been an idea. I should have spoke to you sooner.
Do you know how many other states, if any, that are having a Harriet Tubman Day?
I do know that Maryland, and I also believe Pennsylvania, is doing a number of activities. The Maryland program has been working quite some time at honoring Harriet Tubman, and they have a number of events, and also Pennsylvania. I really think that we should do more to make it sort of a national day where she's honored everywhere. I think go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead, I'm sorry.
What I was getting ready to say is that our history is so important. I was a history major at one point before I decided to run off and be a lawyer, and I understand from that just how important you're able to go forward by knowing from whence you came. And I think something that is missing sometimes is that we don't get the message to youth about exactly where we came from. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know, we're often willing to complain about the trials and tribulations, for example, we deal with our economy, et cetera. But if you can imagine, or if kids could imagine just being judged totally by their color, being grabbed at any given moment, could be killed. I mean, the scars that Harriet Tubman bore was because she was beaten, because they thought she was lazy. At a young age when no child should be working at all. And then even as she got older, she always was at the whim of her masters. I mean, part of the reason why she decided to run away in her 20s was that she was worried about being sold off into slavery, which could happen at any given time. And it did not matter whether you were married, whether you had children, et cetera. Indeed, she got to see the pain of her mother as her slave master separated their family. Some of her sisters that she was never able to see again. I mean, it was just painful for her to see that. And her brothers, her trip back after she had secured her own freedom was to go back and get her family members and bring them forward. And that kind of anguish, to be away from those that love you, being beaten at any given moment, being in a position where you never got paid for your wages, and just that disrespect of not even considering you a person. You were only property. You could be bought and sold. You could be abused. There was times when if you couldn't take the beatings, and you died, some states allowed you to get compensation back from the state for the fact that you lost a slave.
You know, Harriet was known to have used guns. Do you know if she ever turned on any of her slaveholders? Did she ever visit any violence upon them?
Well, she never physically, well, what I will say is that after she became, we do not know of her shooting any of her slave masters or beating them, but we do know that after she, after the Civil War, or during the period of the Civil War, she was in a position of leading troops. She's the only woman to have done that at the time. And she was able to lead Union soldiers, and they pillaged certain areas and certainly got like hundreds of slaves away from away from bondage. And I'm sure there was some violence there. I don't know that she personally did any of that, but you know, it was a rough business at the time. And you know, you think of it, people often think that what slaves did was just kind of grin and enjoy the experience and kind of were resigned to it, but it wasn't that way. I mean, there were uprisings, there were people running away, there were people fighting back, resurrections where some of the slave masters were killed. And I have no doubt that, you know, if she got in a position, she had a rifle, and she would use it if she had to.
Is it true that she had two husbands?
Yes, and that's a interesting, fun, interesting human story, because her first husband was a freeman. He had married her. It's not known, I don't think, exactly how that happened, but she, well, except they fell in love, and she married him. And then when she secured her freedom, she came back and tried to convince him to come with her. But he had remarried, I guess, in those days, marriage, especially amongst slaves and even other blacks, was not this, didn't have the same sanctity and stamp of the law that it has now. So he had remarried, and so she had to leave without him. And it's interesting that years later, he was in a position where he was along a roadway, got into an argument with a white man, and he killed him. And so she lived on, and she was able to marry a second husband who was a soldier in the war, the Civil War, a proud, tall black man. And she married him, and they lived together, I think it was almost 19 years, and he died of, I think, tuberculosis, and got, and so the second marriage lasted forever. And indeed, the irony of it is that as hard as she fought in the Civil War, her own pension was denied her, but she was able to use his pension to try to live on. She had a very difficult life at the end where she did not have a lot of financial resources. There was efforts made to try to get her more money, and she relied on some of the other abolitionists, especially some of the white abolitionists that had more money to assist her to make it so that she could make it. As you bring that up, it's really sad that even after all she did, that she wasn't just revered. One of the things, the horrible things that happened to her was that as she was leaving, I guess, the site of one of the war, she was a soldier, and she had her soldier's papers, and she's sitting there thinking she's going north to home and things would be fine, but some folks that were on the train that she was on told her that she had to move to the back. And that's interesting in light of the fact that Rosa Parks was born the same year she died. She had to move to the back. She was supposed to, and she wouldn't do it. So they had to carry her, and they actually injured her as they did so. It's really an insult to injury, having gone through all that and been such a hero and then being treated like that. And then also in her later years, having to deal with the indignity of not having enough money to be able to survive adequately.
How many kids does she have?
She had no kids. She had no kids. She did have a niece that had come to live, that sort of was an adopted daughter, and she had her stay with her, but no kids from either one of her husbands.
Now, you mentioned that she was injured on this train ride.
Yes.
And, did she suffer a head injury, and was she subjected to having spells?
Yes. There's so much in the story about her. Not only is she a small woman, a slave, and one that had to deal with, bondage, et cetera, but she was, for all intents and purposes, dealing with the problem of a medical condition. One day when she was very young, she went to town, the town store, which still exists. It's still there. She went to town in Maryland, and there was a slave who the master was upset because the person was not where they were supposed to be. And so the master kind of wanted her to help him with that. Instead, she stood in the middle, and he picked up a weight and threw it at her and hit her in the head. And once he hit her in the head, after that, oftentimes she had these spells. She saw them as her visions. She saw them as sort of part of her spirituality. But if you can imagine somebody that's leading people through swamps, et cetera, and all of a sudden she just would fall asleep. They've either called it epilepsy or narcolepsy that she has had. But it's just, you know, it was amazing that it was so difficult. And I think later in her life, she ended up having surgery to try to relieve some of the pressure in her head because of that. And in typical Harriet Tubman fashion, instead of sort of being kind of put to sleep about it, she grinned and bore it and was and had this sort of surgery to try to make it better. But it was something she had to deal with all her life, where it was just always, it was painful. It wasn't just that she fell asleep, but that it was also painful.
How old was she when she died?
Well, that's, you know, that's open to question because it's not really known exactly when she was born because in those days, of course, slaves did not, there was no record of when they were, you know, when they were born, unless it was in a Bible or something like that. It's believed that it was in 1822 or 1820 or thereabouts, and then she would have died in 1913. So.
And how old was she when she got injured?
She was in her, I think she was in her teens. Somewhere in her teens was when she was injured. And then she was in her early 20s when she sought her freedom, which was in 1849. And then that's when she started her treks back, I think it was about 13 missions back to Maryland to free family members and others.
How many siblings did she have? And did she free all of them, many of them?
She did. There was, I think, eight or nine kids. I think it was eight. And as I said, some of those kids found themselves in a position of never being with the family again because they were sold off into slavery. You bring up kids. I mean, her mother, you know, her mother was a kind of strong-willed person who tried her best to kind of keep the family together. At one point, there was a son that was almost sold off into slavery, and the mother and family members and friends hid him out in the woods to try to keep the master from selling him. And at some point, when they could hide him no more, and he was in the house with his mother, she basically told the master that she would split his head open if he came in and took her son. So he could tell she was serious, so that son did not get sold away. The interesting thing was that her parents were on different plantations, so the family unit was not sort of under one roof for quite some time. Later they were, but she still saw all of them as family and was close to them. Indeed, one of her last trips north was to bring her family, her mother and father, up north. They had, at that time, actually been freed. But the problem was they had helped other slaves escape. So she was very worried that what would happen is they would be taken off and sold into slavery, because that all oftentimes is what would happen if you did something to violate the rules, which were that slaves were supposed to stay where they were. You could find yourself sold into slavery. White people at the time were often fined or jailed. Or had to deal with something such as that, but the ultimate insult would be that blacks would be sold.
Excuse me, Penny, I believe we have a caller. Uh-huh. Caller 504, your line is open. Do you have a question or comment? Number 504, are you there?
Oh, 50, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't realize you were doing the area code. I'm just calling to listen.
Oh, I thought you had a question or comment. Okay.
Not at this time. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Certainly. Anyone else there that on the call-in line, do you have a question or comment?
I would add for your listeners that if they come down to the event in Delaware, they're certainly to learn a lot about Harriet Tubman and have a unique experience. We even have a reenactor that's going to play the part of Harriet Tubman, not only for the general consumption, but also for the children that arrive. And it's not too late to register at HarrietTubmanJourney.org. And if you register today while this program is going on, if you enter the code HTJ, it will cost you $20 instead of the regular $25 registration fee.
What other attractions will be available to visitors there, such as museums, zoos, concert halls, and particularly any black-owned restaurants and black-owned other businesses?
Well, first of all, I would tell you just this is not black-owned, but the park itself is the Tubman Garrett Riverfront Park, and we have a wonderful, absolutely wonderful statue that you can enjoy while you're down there. I'm trying to think of Evelyn's, that's not too far away. They have the greatest fish. so that's one place that you could enjoy. There's also a number of Jamaican restaurants that aren't that far away from the area in terms of consumption. Trying to think of other...
You have the T-shirts that anyone...
Yes, we definitely do. Maryland has consented to allow us to use their logo. There's an official Harriet Tubman logo, and it's very nice. And we will have commemorative T-shirts available for purchase. And if you register, you get a T-shirt that goes with it. We're also having a bag of kind of goodies, and instead of the traditional just items that you might have, we also are including history cards and information about the byway and about the sites that you might see in Delaware that are related to the Underground Railroad. We've tried to make this a event that inspires, educates, and allows others to reminisce and remember. So that's kind of our mission. I mean, Harriet Tubman has always been so important to me, and I want her to be so important for generations to come.
Well, the Gift of Freedom sends out a lot of love to you and to your sponsors for this great event that you're putting together. And before we go to our reading, would you give us the contact information again?
Yes.
I believe your number was 302-514-7785.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay,
and our website is HarrietTubmanJourney.org, and you can also reach us on Facebook at Harriet Tubman Journey. And remember, all of this is to give back to our communities, our kids and adults that are having a difficult time, because the proceeds will go to charities.
Let's give out those websites one more time.
Be happy to. HarrietTubmanJourney.org, and the Facebook is Harriet Tubman Journey.
And we want to remind everyone that anyone can buy a T-shirt online, right?
Yes, they can.
So they should be getting online right now to get that commemorative T-shirt. That phone number again, where Ms. Marshall can be contacted, is 302-514-7785. Yes, ma'am. You got something else you want to say?
Yes, the other thing I'd like to say is this has been such a sort of moving experience that I would also appreciate that if people do go on Facebook that they express their thoughts, express their feelings about Harriet Tubman and what she's meant to them. I think that we've all grown from the experience of putting this together and also spreading the word about her bravery, her resilience, and her willingness to do for others. As we now live in a time where there's too much violence against each other in our communities, and we live at a time that folks do not sit down and work out ways to enhance our society, they argue back and forth. She was willing to work with others, black abolitionists, white abolitionists, just for a common good. And so it's hope that her story will make it so that we do better than we're doing now.
Great. Well, thank you for being with us, Penny Marshall, who is the chairperson for the Harriet Tubman Day celebration in Delaware. Upcoming now will be a reading of the Black Abolitionist. Listeners should pay particular attention to the petition movement that's going to be talked about, and also the Underground Railroad in Texas, Mexico, and mention of the Mexican War and the Underground Railroad and how Mexico refused to extradite self-emancipated slaves. And again, Penny Marshall has been our guest here, and we should be moving into our reading of the Black Abolitionist. Thank you again, Penny. And please,
and thank you for having me.
If you have the time, stick around and listen to the reading and maybe join in the discussion after.
Yes, I will. I will try to do that for a time.
Okay.
I've got to get ready for Sunday, so I'm working nonstop, but I will listen for a time.
Well, I understand.
Thank you. Thank
okay.
you.
Black Abolitionists by Benjamin Quarles, continued. Cassette 6, Side 1.
Good evening.
And blessings.
And welcome to another installment of the Gist of Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author, Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
With the coming of the new abolitionists after 1830, the use of the petition reached flood proportions. To put his name down on a long sheet of paper under a statement condemning slavery became second nature to a new school abolitionist, even to a follower of Garrison who decried such political activity as voting or holding office. The massive abolition petition against slavery began in 1835, and, it is hardly necessary to add, with the full backing of the black abolitionists. 3 years earlier, the Massachusetts General Colored Association, meeting in Boston, had voted to send a petition to Congress to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia. During the following spring, at two meetings held at the African Masonic Hall in Boston, Maria W. Stewart gave an analysis of the Negro's problem and suggested a step for its solution. "Most of our color," she said, "have been taught to stand in fear of the white man from their earliest infancy, to work as soon as they can walk, and call master before they could scarce lisp the name of mother. What should be done about changing things? Let every man sign a petition to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia and grant you the rights and privileges of common citizens." A few weeks later, on June 16, 1833, a petition was drafted in the name of 1,200 Negroes of Providence, Rhode Island, and sent to Andrew Jackson. reminding the chief executive of his commendation of the Negro troops under him at the Battle of New Orleans in January 1815, the Providence Negroes urged Jackson to free the slaves in the District of Columbia and in the territories of Arkansas and Florida, and entreated him not to forget the million of our brethren and sisters still in slavery. Hundreds of abolitionist petitions were directed against the annexation of the Republic of Texas, which had won its independence from Mexico in 1836. If Texas came into the Union, it would come in, as abolitionists well knew, as a slave state. The New York Vigilance Society was one of the Negro groups that opposed the annexation. At the Broadway Tabernacle on August 1, 1837, the Society opened a booth at which passers-by could sign a petition against the admission of Texas and against slavery in the district. A year earlier, at its first annual meeting, the American Moral Reform Society had gone on record as opposing Texas annexation. They had also thanked John Quincy Adams for having fought to maintain the right to petition, irrespective of color or condition. Although himself not an abolitionist, Adams had become an admired figure among them as a consequence of his fight against the gag rule. First passed in the House of Representatives in May 1836, this was a measure declaring that all petitions relating to slavery should be laid on the table, not sent to a committee and reported back, as was customary. This measure backfired, however, since it struck at a basic constitutional right. Abolitionists became more petition-minded than ever, and Adams became their chief means of transmission, presenting petition after petition, despite the threats of his House colleagues to censure or expel him. One of the largest petitions ever reaching the Washington office of Congressman Adams was an immense roll of paper, about the size of a barrel. It bore 51,862 signatures, headed by the name George Latimer. A runaway slave from Norfolk, Virginia, Latimer had been arrested and placed in a Boston jail in October 1842. Abolitionists and Negroes rallied to his defense, attempting to have him released by a writ of habeas corpus. When this proved unsuccessful, the abolitionists held a mass meeting at Faneuil Hall on October 30th, followed by a series of Latimer meetings throughout the state. "I have never known people so aroused before," wrote Samuel E. Sewell, legal counsel for Latimer and one of the speakers at the Faneuil Hall gathering. To coordinate the abolitionist protest, a Latimer committee was appointed, made up of Henry I. Bowditch, William F. Channing, and Frederick Cabot. This trio brought out a weekly, the Latimer Weekly and North Star. Another committee operation was the promotion of two monster petitions, one to the state legislature and another to the national legislature. The Great Massachusetts Petition, calling for a state law forbidding the use of public property or the services of public officials in the detention or arrest of any alleged fugitive. The Great Petition to Congress asked that such laws or amendments be passed as would separate the people of Massachusetts from all connection with slavery. The two Latimer petitions won the full support of Negroes. Indeed, 5 months before Latimer was arrested, a group of Boston Negroes had pledged themselves to draft a petition to the incoming state legislature which would prohibit citizens and officials of Massachusetts from aiding slaveholders in seizing and returning fugitives. They also unanimously agreed to petition Congress to repeal the Fugitive Slave Law of 1793. Late in November, at a meeting held at the Belknap Street Baptist Church, a Negro gathering protested the imprisonment of Latimer and pledged themselves to support the two petitions being circulated by the Latimer Committee. At Hartford's Fifth Congregational Church on November 17, 1842, the Reverend J.W.C. Pennington delivered a sermon on the Latimer case, "Covenants Involving Moral Wrong Not Obligatory Upon Man." "Don't let Charles Dickens hear of the Latimer case," pleaded Pennington, "lest he write an addendum to his Notes on America." If the Latimer case did not reach international proportions, it was due to the uneasiness of James B. Gray, the owner of Latimer. Surprised by the depth of feeling which the case aroused throughout New England, and fearful of the countercharges launched by Latimer's legal advisors, Gray decided to sell him for $400. The abolitionists were highly pleased at this turn of events, but they did not propose to abandon their petition drive. By mid-February 1843, the two petitions were delivered to their respective destinations. The petition to the Massachusetts legislature, bearing 64,526 signatures and weighing 150 pounds, was delivered at the State House on February 17, 1843, by Charles Francis Adams. 5 weeks later, the legislature passed a measure dubbed by the delighted abolitionists as the Latimer Statute, because it was so closely modeled after their petition. A similar fate eluded the companion petition that went to John Quincy Adams in Washington. This petition shared a common graveyard with such previous stillborns as the one from 9 Negro women in Fredericksburg, Virginia, presented by Adams in February 1837, the petition from New York Negroes in June 1838, protesting against the treatment of American colored seamen in Cuba, and the petition by Boston Negroes in October 1842, bitterly complaining about the treatment given to black sailors in 5 southern states. But if such petitions got nowhere, it was not the fault of those presenting them, and John Quincy Adams continued to receive expressions of high esteem from Negroes. His death in 1848, 4 years after the repeal of the gag rule, was widely mourned by Negroes. Commemorative meetings were held by colored people in Detroit, Cincinnati, Buffalo, New York, and Philadelphia. Adams had never been a professing abolitionist, and his bald and pot-bellied exterior hardly cast him in a heroic mold. But to Negroes, he was a fearless advocate of the rights of man, and this was a breed none too numerous, as their experience had taught them. To the various state legislatures in the North came petitions from Negro residents. As a rule, these memorials dealt with discriminatory measures, impending or already enacted, against colored people. These petitions had one other thing in common. Their instigators were almost invariably active abolitionists. For example, the 11-page memorial sent to the Pennsylvania Assembly in March 1832, protesting against a proposed bill severely limiting Negro migration to Pennsylvania, was planned at a meeting at which James C. McCrummel was chairman and Jacob C. White was secretary. The petition was worded by 3 men of equal reputation as black abolitionists, James Fortin, Robert Purvis, and William Whipper. In their petitions to state legislatures, then, Negroes were not addressing themselves solely to local or internal grievances. They were, at the same time, leveling their pieces at much bigger game, the jungle king of slavery. Abolitionists found that political activity brought some gains, but it had its limitations. Petitions were of little good unless they were followed up. Voting for a winning candidate did not ensure the desired legislation, and even the law itself, particularly a new law, often turned out to be less binding than social and economic pressures. These strong pressures came to the fore in American life with a compelling urgency in the 1850s. And, with a twist that was not wholly surprising, they made their debut with a law relating to fugitive slaves. Chapter 9. Protests, New Prophets. Thursday, May 25, 1854. Did not intend to write this evening, but another fugitive from bondage has been arrested like a criminal in the streets. Diary of Charlotte Fortin. It was the first time, this October 5, 1850, at 12 noon, that New York Negroes had ever held a meeting in the public park. But then there had never been so large a black audience or so deeply moving an occasion. 5,000 people had gathered to welcome home a fellow New Yorker who had been gone hardly a week. Moreover, he was dressed as a laborer, and hence could hardly have been a community leader or member of the black elite. But when the 30-year-old porter stood up, after being introduced by the presiding officer, the audience cheered with deafening effect, drowning out the sobbing and the crying, some of which came from the guest of honor himself. For this man was a fugitive slave, James Hamlet, who had been seized on the streets of New York 9 days earlier. Hamlet had offered as his defense the fact that he was a free man, having entitled himself to his freedom. But his line of reasoning lacked admissible legal precedent. In fact, the testimony of an alleged fugitive was invalid by law. Hence, Hamlet had been arrested and returned to his Baltimore mistress. A few days later, New York Negroes held a mass meeting at Mother Zion Church, with many whites present, for the purpose of raising enough money to buy Hamlet. Amid great enthusiasm, the purchase price of $800 was raised. One Negro, Isaac Hollenbeck, starting things off with a donation of $100. Now Hamlet was home again, no longer melancholy, but restored to his family, friends, and job. Standing before the gathering in the park, Hamlet waved his dampened handkerchief while a bevy of women gathered around his wife and child. "Such kissing and crying never were seen," wrote a contemporary. When things quieted down, there were speeches by William P. Powell, Charles B. Ray, John Peter Thompson, and Robert Hamilton. But there was none from Hamlet, his heart too full. "He is a free man. That is a speech itself," explained Hamilton. The exercises closed with the singing of a hymn, and then Hamlet was hoisted in the air and borne on shoulders through the park and to his home. The Hamlet case was hardly a victory over slavery, for, as William P. Powell had remarked, it was brought about not by the irresistible genius of universal emancipation, but by the irresistible genius of the almighty dollar. What gave the Hamlet case its dramatic impact was its timing. It took place a week after President Fillmore had signed into law a measure that shook the North, its subject, the fugitive slave. One of five measures known collectively as the Compromise of 1850, the fugitive slave law provoked an unprecedented hue and cry. The law denied both the testimony of the alleged runaway and his right to a trial by jury, and it assumed his guilt rather than his innocence. Such a measure could have been swallowed by Congress only because it was part of a package, for it violated the basic concepts of American law and the procedural guarantees of the Constitution. Hence, it recharged the emotional slavery debate, greatly widening the breach between the sections. In the North, the measure was condemned and defied, and in the South, this condemnation and defiance was regarded as an act of bad faith. The fugitive slave law gave to the abolitionists a weapon which they would exploit to the hilt. In this chorus of condemnation, no voices were louder than those of the Negro. But long before the abolitionist attack could reach its full proportions, many runaway slaves living in the North had decided to take to the road again, this time to Canada. The law was ex post facto, reaching back to fugitives who had almost forgotten that they had not always been free. Former runaways feared that the law might be enforced, a view sustained in some legal quarters that were friendly to the slave. Upon passage of the law, George T. Downing and William P. Powell had written William Jay, asking his advice on its constitutionality and binding force. The former judge had little for their comfort. "You ask me how you shall secure yourselves from the kidnapper. God only knows." Jay urged the Negroes not to turn to violence, to leave the pistol and the bowie knife to Southern ruffians and their Northern mercenaries. A group of New York Negroes sought the advice of another friendly figure, Congressman Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, as to the constitutionality of the new law. Stevens replied that he had little hope that the measure would not be upheld by the federal courts. Hence, he could advise nothing better than the subjects of it put themselves beyond its reach. Many fugitive slaves, apprehensive of their freedom in the land of the fugitive slave law, made ready to take their departure. The black exodus touched every northern city with more than a handful of Negroes. This embraced even Boston, with its tradition of challenging unpopular laws and defying the official charged with enforcing them. 40 former slaves bade farewell to Boston within 60 hours after the Fugitive Slave Bill became law. The city's colored churches were particularly hard hit. The African Methodist Church lost 85 members, and the much smaller Zion Methodist Church lost 10. The First Baptist Church lost 40 of its 125 enrollees. The congregation of the 12th Baptist Church quickly dwindled from 141 to 81, and two of its deacons were retained only because the members had raised $1,300 to buy their freedom. Some of these departees to Canada were relatives of runaways, and a few might have been freeborn Negroes who felt jeopardized. But in Boston, as elsewhere, the fugitive slave law revealed that the number of runaways was greater than most people would have thought. For members taking flight, the churches in upstate New York could match those in Boston. The Baptist Colored Church of Buffalo lost 130 members after the pastor told the congregation that he found gospel precedent for running away, but none that warranted fighting. At the Colored Baptist Church of Rochester, the Kentucky-born pastor was the first to quit the city, and he was soon followed by 112 members of his flock, leaving two behind. At Pittsburgh, a group of 200 Negroes left for Canada a few days before the signing of the Fugitive Slave Law. They carried firearms, having vowed that they would die before being taken back into slavery. Pittsburgh lost an additional 800 Negroes, over half of whom were relatives of runaways. Another Pennsylvania city, Columbia, lost 487 of its 943 Negroes during the five-year span after the passage of the law. William Whipper assisted many of the Canada-bound emigrants, helping them to sell such possessions as they could not carry, particularly houses and real estate. At both Columbia and Pittsburgh, a runaway who had been taken into custody was purchased by Negroes, Whipper heading the effort of Columbia and John B. Vachon at Pittsburgh. To most Negroes, outright defiance was a more emotionally satisfying response to the Fugitive Slave Law than flight outside the country or raising money to pay a master. Hence, Negroes throughout the North held anti-fugitive slave law meetings. On October 2, 1850, some 1,500 black New Yorkers jammed into the Zion Chapel for a protest meeting. The presiding officer, William P. Powell, set the tone in a series of opening questions. "You are told to submit peacefully to the laws. Will you do so?" "No, no." "You are told to kiss the manacles that bind you. Will you do so?" "No, no, no." Other speakers took up this refrain, which was reaffirmed by the formal resolutions utterly repudiating a law so repugnant to every principle of justice. Before the meeting adjourned, two petitions condemning the law were circulated, one to the state legislature and the other to Congress. A week later, the Negroes of Elmira vowed that they would defy the Fugitive Slave Law at the sacrifice of their lives. Negroes elsewhere voiced similar sentiments. 10 days after the Fugitive Slave Law went into operation, a group of Pittsburgh Negroes held a meeting at the public square. They condemned the Pennsylvania congressman who had supported the slave bill, which they declared to be a deadly blow at liberty. The most stirring remarks came from Martin R. Delaney, who said that he hoped that the ground would refuse his body if a slaveholder crossed his threshold and he did not lay him a lifeless corpse at his feet. An even more impassioned statement came from Robert Purvis, presiding at the annual meeting of the Pennsylvania Anti-Slavery Society at Westchester on October 17, 1850. His eyes flashing, Purvis declared that, "Should any wretch enter my dwelling, any pale-faced specter among ye, to execute this law on me or mine, I'll seek his life, I'll shed his blood." Parker Pillsbury, deeply moved by the outburst, wrote that the Fugitive Slave Law was revealed in all its horror when it could move a man like Purvis to such extremity. Negroes elsewhere shared the defiant mood of Delaney and Purvis. New York Negroes held a meeting which sanctioned forcible resistance to the Fugitive Slave Law, the chairman appointing a committee to assist endangered runaways. Less than a week after the passage of the measure, a large and enthusiastic group of Negroes met at Quinn Chapel in Chicago and proceeded to organize the Liberty Association. 42 men, working in teams, were to patrol the city, spying for possible slave hunters. At Zanesville, Ohio, a group of Muskingum County Negroes met in November 1850 and formally declared that if they heard of anyone being arrested as a fugitive, they would leave our several employments to come to his assistance. 2 months later, at a statewide meeting of colored citizens at Columbus, the Fugitive Slave Law was denounced as an outrage upon humanity. Boston Negroes held a protest meeting of a resolute and enthusiastic character at the Belknap Street Church on October 4, 1850. Following a series of addresses of a most emphatic type, a resolution was adopted pledging its sponsors to resist unto death any attempt upon their liberties. But some of the fugitives who were present expressed the wish for a large-scale public expression of support. These former slaves were apprehensive, having witnessed the departure and anticipating the impending departure of others of their kind. 10 days later, such a reassurance meeting was held at Faneuil Hall, an appropriate site. The call to the meeting had been signed by Josiah Quincy, former mayor of Boston, and 340 other white abolitionists. With hundreds milling outside the packed hall, the meeting allayed any fears as to the abolitionists' support in defying the law. On the platform, the presiding officer, Charles Francis Adams, was flanked by Richard Henry Dana, substituting for the ailing Josiah Quincy, Theodore Parker, Wendell Phillip, Frederick Douglass, Charles Lennox Remond, and runaways William and Ellen Craft. After stating the purpose of the meeting, Adams called upon Douglass to state the conditions of the colored people under this new act of oppression. Arising amid an ovation, the much-sought-after orator and former slave did not mince words. Boston Negroes, he said, had vowed to die rather than return to bondage. We must be prepared, should this law be put into operation, to see the streets of Boston running with blood. As if to bear out his assertion, Douglass recited the stories of fugitives who had exhibited unusual daring and courage. Then he asked the audience whether it would permit slaveholders to seize a Negro in Boston. Faneuil Hall's rafters echoed to the cry of no. Douglass closed on a personal note, saying that a rumor had reached Rochester, where he lived, that a group of slave hunters were after him and would visit his home. He had resolved to meet them, and as his house was rather small and the party probably rather large, he went up to a trap door in the attic in order to receive them one at a time. This forceful address set the tone for the remaining speeches and actions. Two resolutions were adopted, one calling for the repeal of the fugitive slave law, and the other proclaiming that, Constitution or no Constitution, we will not allow a fugitive slave to be taken from Massachusetts. A 50-member committee of vigilance was empowered to set up an office to give advice and assistance to fugitive slaves. I am happy to state, wrote Douglass the following morning, that the public meeting held here last night had done much toward quieting the colored people. As it turned out, this optimism was shattered by an occurrence the very next day. Two agents of Dr. Robert Collins of Macon, Georgia, owner of William and Ellen Craft, had arrived in Boston and obtained warrants for their arrest. Wrote Douglass in a hurried dispatch to his weekly, Mr. Craft is armed and resolved to stand his ground, and in less than an hour blood may flow in the streets of Boston. No blood was shed, but not because Craft was unarmed. The clergyman, Theodore Parker, had inspected his weapons, although confessing that it was rather a new business for him. But Parker's analysis bore a professional ring. His powder had a good kernel, and he kept it dry. His pistols were of excellent proof, the barrels true and clean. The trigger went easy. The caps would not hang fire at the snap. I tested his poniard. The blade had a good temper, stiff enough, yet springy withal. The point was sharp. When Henry I. Bowditch offered to drive Craft across town, the former slave agreed upon condition that Bowditch arm himself. The two drove in Bowditch's buggy, Craft with a revolver in one hand and a pistol in the other. The two agents of Collins were told that they had better get out of Boston, and one of them heeded the advice. However, the Crafts decided that they too would leave. Upon the advice of well-wishers, they hastened out of the country, having received $250 from the Boston Vigilance Committee to pay their passage to England. But the attending excitement did not die down. The Crafts episode proved to be but one in a highly dramatic series involving the rendition of runaways. Defiance of the fugitive slave law became a new commandment to abolitionists throughout the North. The rescue of slaves who had been taken in custody did not begin in 1850, however. It was something that Negroes had been doing for nearly two decades. In the early summer of 1833, a group of Detroit Negroes rescued two slaves, wounding the sheriff in the process and leading the mayor to issue a call for federal troops. In the following spring, several Negroes in Philadelphia were sent to the penitentiary for an attempt to seize a slave from the police, the court having authorized his delivery to his master. Late in July 1836, Boston was the scene of a rescue which came to be known as the Abolition Riot. Two slaves, Eliza Small and Polly Ann Bates, were claimed as runaway slaves belonging to John B. Morris of Baltimore and brought to court. While the attorney for Morris was addressing the judge, someone in the spectator section shouted, "Go, go!" Whereupon some colored people rushed to the bench and bore the prisoners down the courthouse steps and shoved them into a waiting carriage. A colored woman of great size, who scrubbed floors for a living, threw her arms around the neck of one officer, immobilizing him. Eliza and Polly were never recaptured, and their abettors went scot-free, although Sheriff C.P. Sumner, father of Charles Sumner, was criticized for permitting such a breach of the peace. In Chicago, in October 1846, while the case of two runaway slaves from Missouri was in progress in court, a crowd of Negroes and their white sympathizers gathered around the officers and carried the slaves away. At Pittsburgh, a year later, a group of Negroes seized a runaway from two Virginia constables who had placed him under arrest. Up to 1850, the rescuing of fugitive slaves had been a business conducted almost exclusively by Negroes. The Fugitive Slave Law of that year brought an influx of new blood into the work. This the Negro abolitionists welcomed heartily, but they did not use it as an excuse to retire to the sidelines. The Shadrach rescue is a case in point. An employee at the Cornhill Coffee House in Boston, Fred Wilkins, or Shadrach as he was popularly known, was seized at noon on February 15, 1851, and rushed to the courthouse with his waiter's apron still on. The news spread as if with wings, the Negro residential section being nearby. Five lawyers, including Robert Morris, a Negro, had just succeeded in obtaining a court delay to prepare for the defense when the rescue took place. A group of some 50 Negroes pressed into the courtroom, lifted Shadrach in the air, and bore him to the street. His clothes half torn off, Shadrach was placed in a carriage, and soon the rescued and the rescuers were moving away like a black squall. There was no pursuit, the seizure having been so sudden and unexpected. Taking refuge in Canada, Shadrach was beyond the reach of American law. But some of his rescuers did not escape legal action. On February 18, 1851, President Fillmore issued a special proclamation ordering that proceedings be commenced against the aiders or abettors in this flagitious offense. Robert Morris and Lewis Hayden were among those indicted for complicity in the rescue. Neither was ever sentenced. On June 16, 1851, the jury trying Hayden reported that it had been unable to reach a verdict. 5 months later, the Morris case came to an end. The federal authorities had tried to charge him with treason, but the grand jury had him bound over for a misdemeanor. On November 11, 1851, the jury that heard the case, United States versus Robert Morris, returned a verdict of not guilty. Boston had two cases of runaways being sent back to slavery, but in each instance the Fugitive Slave Law won a clouded victory at best. Early in April 1851, while the abolitionists were still in the pleasant afterglow of the Shadrach rescue, Thomas Sims, a fugitive from Georgia, was seized. Sims was rushed to the courthouse, a gloomy granite building that the federal authorities had to use as a jail, Massachusetts law preventing the use of state facilities for fugitive slave purposes. Legal efforts to free Sims were unsuccessful. A plot to effect his escape was equally abortive. Leonard A. Grimes visited Sims and told him that a mattress would be placed outside his window at a certain hour, and that he was to jump and land on it and be spirited away. But before the scheme could be put into operation, the courthouse authorities put bars on every window. Taking additional precautions, especially to secure the doorways, they placed an iron chain around the building, already encircled by 100 policemen. Shortly before sunrise on April 13th, Sims was marched to the Long Wharf to be shipped back to slavery. Despite the early hour, 100 abolitionists were present, marching solemnly behind a cordon of policemen three times their number. As Sims, tear-streaked but erect, marched up the gangplank, someone cried out, "Sims, preach liberty to the slaves." The sorrowing abolitionists made their way back to the anti-slavery office, pausing on State Street at the spot where the black Crispus Attucks fell in the Boston Massacre of March 5, 1770, an event signaling the Revolutionary War. Sims was gone, but he left behind more than the coat he wore on the day he was seized, as prized as it became among abolitionists. His seizure gave to the recently reorganized Vigilance Committee a reason for being, thus attracting new supporters and swelling its coffers. Many of its meetings were held at the home of Lewis Hayden. In 1851, the committee assisted 69 fugitives of record. It had on its payroll 49 Negroes who harbored slaves pending their final disposition. John S. Rock, then practicing medicine rather than law, was paid by the committee for his services to sick fugitives. Despite the efforts of Boston abolitionists, white and black, a runaway slave was taken from the city in the spring of 1854. This was the celebrated Anthony Burns, who had learned to read and write in slavery, having had a kindly disposed master. Late in May 1854, Burns was arrested as a fugitive slave and put in irons. 2 days later, an attempt was made to storm the courthouse and seize Burns, but the attack was repulsed, one of the deputies, however, being shot and killed. During the following week, while the city awaited the commissioner's decision, feeling ran high. "Beg our colored friends to bear and forbear," wrote John Greenleaf Whittier. "Oh, let them beware of violence." The black people thronged around the courthouse, showing their sympathy by watching around the clock. Burns needed sympathy, as United States Commissioner Edward G. Loring had returned a verdict in favor of his master. Richard Henry Dana and Leonard Grimes hastened to the courthouse to be with the prisoner and attempt to raise his spirits. Later that day, many shops were hung in black, and a huge coffin was strung over State Street. "Our worst fears are realized," wrote 16-year-old Charlotte Fortin in her diary for June 2, 1854. "A cloud seems hanging over me, over all our persecuted race, which nothing can dispel." One thing remained, to get Burns from the courthouse to the wharf to be put aboard a revenue cutter that was bound for Virginia. From the courthouse door, a loaded gun was mounted, and from the courthouse to the wharf, the streets were lined with police. In the center of the armed posse marched Burns. He had expected to have Dana and Grimes walking beside him, but the marshal of the posse had gone back on his word to permit such an arrangement. 50,000 spectators witnessed the procession as it made its way past buildings draped in black. One of these viewers was a good-looking young Negro girl whose teeth were clenched and whose eyes were tearful. Samuel Gridley Howe attempted to console her, saying that Burns would not be hurt. "Hurt," she said, "I cry for shame that he will not kill himself. Oh, why is he not man enough to kill himself?" Charlotte Fortin expressed the belief that very few clergymen would speak out against the cruel outrage on humanity represented by the rendition of Burns. The fearless Theodore Parker could be numbered in that select company, preaching a sermon which asserted that in the wicked week of 1854, Massachusetts was one of the inferior counties of Virginia, and Boston but a suburb of Alexandria. It is hardly surprising that when William J. Watkins had heard Parker 6 months earlier, he had come to the conclusion that no man preached more truth. The rendition of Anthony Burns left the abolitionists frustrated and angry, but its sequel was more to their liking. The revulsion of feeling throughout Massachusetts prompted the legislature to pass a more comprehensive personal liberty law in 1855, one which practically made the fugitive slave law a dead letter in the Bay State. Public opinion was changing, with abolitionists coming to be regarded less as traitors and more as patriots. Moreover, Burns remained a slave for less than a year. His new master, unlike his predecessor, was willing to set him at liberty for a price. With money raised in abolitionist circles, Leonard A. Grimes went to Baltimore to complete the transaction and accompanied Burns back to the Free States and a joyous welcome. Shortly thereafter, he entered Oberlin, where he remained for 2 years before enrolling at the Fairmount Theological Seminary at Cincinnati. Except in the far West, the defiance of the fugitive slave law was widespread. The locale of slave rescues ranged from Massachusetts to the Middle Atlantic states and those bordering the Great Lakes and known collectively as the Old Northwest. Three representative examples of slave recaptures may be briefly noted, including the typical role played by black activists. In New York, the most celebrated instance of the law's defiance was the rescue of William Henry on October 1, 1851, at Syracuse. A muscular mulatto who went by the name Jerry, he was known to be a runaway, but his conduct had been above reproach, and his employer, C.P. Williston, had found no complaint with his work as a cooper. Seized and taken to the federal commissioner's office, Jerry was in the process of being indicted when he slipped his guard and dashed out of the building and down the street. But being manacled, he was caught by the police, and after a stiff fight, the battered and disheveled prisoner was returned to the commissioner's office. The news of the incident spread rapidly, and within a few hours the abolitionists had formulated a rescue plan. Shortly after 8 o'clock that evening, a group of men dashed into the police office, overwhelmed the guards by sheer numbers, battered down the door to the room Jerry was in, and took him. The first persons reaching him were two Negroes, Peter Hollenbeck and William Gray, the latter a runaway. Jerry was first taken to the home of a colored man, where his shackles were removed. Then, to avoid suspicion, he was removed to the home of a white friend. Here he remained in hiding for 5 days before beginning his journey to Kingston, Ontario. Someone had to face the music, and the federal government proceeded to indict 18 of the rescuers. Samuel Ringgold Ward, who claimed to have assisted in filing off Jerry's chains, hastened to Montreal. From this retreat, he wrote to George Whipple of the American Missionary Association, offering his services in the Canadian field. Another equally well-known black abolitionist, Germain W. Loguen, also made his way to Her Majesty's dominions. Loguen took the step in response to his wife's urgings. 2 months later, on December 2, 1851, he wrote to Governor Hunt requesting protection should he return to Syracuse. Along with Loguen, 4 other Negroes were indicted: Prince Jackson, William Thompson, Harrison Allen, and Enoch Reed. Only 3 of the 18 rescuers were put on trial, and only one of these, Enoch Reed, was found guilty. He died pending an appeal, which he would have undoubtedly won. The Jerry rescue, in common with others of its kind, had great significance to abolitionists. They did not propose to let it die. Annually, until the Civil War, the reformers in western New York commemorated October 1st as Jerry Rescue Day. At the first anniversary, typical of those which followed, some 2,500 abolitionists came together, including William H. Topp, Frederick Douglass, William G. Allen, and the short-time emigrant Germain W. Loguen. White participants included Daniel Drayton of the Pearl, Samuel J. May, William Lloyd Garrison, and suffragists Lucretia Mott and young Lucy Stone. The speeches that lacked eloquence were not wanting in earnestness. Perhaps the palm went to a practiced scene stealer. "Frederick Douglass gave us some of the thunder of the gods," wrote William G. Allen. Some say that his was the speech of the morning, but I must confess that my heart palpitated toward Lucy, added that ever-gallant, youthful professor of Belles Lettres. The attempted rendition of Jerry took place less than a month before the far more upsetting and highly publicized Christiana riot, the first defiance of the fugitive slave law resulting in bloodshed. To Christiana, a town in southern Pennsylvania, came Edward Gorsuch on September 11, 1851, from bordering Maryland in search of his 4 escaped slaves. Gorsuch and his party of 6 went to the home of William Parker, whom he suspected of harboring one or more of the fugitives. Himself a runaway from Maryland, Parker was in no mood to release an alleged slave, a feeling shared by the other Negroes in the town. Still vivid in their memory was the midnight seizure of a Negro 6 months previously, his abductors, a slave-hunting band known as the Gag Gang, having produced no warrant. When Gorsuch demanded that Parker permit him to enter the house, the latter's wife, Eliza Ann, herself a former runaway, blew a large dinner horn, a signal which summoned some 24 Negroes to the scene. Soon, an exchange of shots took place, resulting in the death of Gorsuch and the wounding of his son. Thereupon, the outnumbered besiegers, already in no mood to press matters, withdrew. 45 Marines and a civil posse of 50 men were dispatched to restore order. The acting Secretary of State, W.S. Derrick, assured the Governor of Maryland that the President deplored this violation of the rights of the citizens of his state and that the federal government would exercise all its powers in bringing the offenders to book. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.
Well, I want to welcome everyone back to the show. Just having completed our reading of The Black Abolitionist by Benjamin Quarles. Quite a bit of information there in reference to the petitions and the gag rule and that sort of thing. They also mention a Jerry Rescue Day. And our show opened up with discussion of the Harriet Tubman Day. If anyone would like to call in and any comments or questions, the number is 347-324-5552. I'm wondering if our guest stayed with us. Penny Marshall, are you there? Okay, probably she had to get to work, as she is the program manager for the Harriet Tubman Day there in the state of Delaware, which will be Sunday, March the 10th. Do I have someone on the line with me?
That's just me, Leslie Gist.
Hi, Leslie.
Hi, I just wanted to thank you for doing an exceptional job and mentioning those great points. If you don't have anything else to say, the lines are open. I see some lines here, but I guess everyone's a little bit too shy.
Okay. Well, I must say I was impressed with the petitions, the amount of signatures that were garnered. That first one was 51,862, and then a petition later on of 64,000 signatures. I believe that was in 1843, weighed 150 pounds. So it seemed that the free blacks in the North were politically savvy enough to use these petitions to further their political rights. And it was probably futile, I think, to present that one petition to Andrew Jackson, which was against the annexation of Texas. I believe that was in 1832 or 1833. And Mr. Jackson was probably consumed with getting the Native Americans out of the southeast part of the United States, getting them ready for the Trail of Tears. So he had very little interest in any petitions against the annexation of Texas, which I
and there's currently people that are opposed to the petitions today. They're saying they're frivolous. So it's funny how, you know, history repeats itself in that regard. Are you familiar with what's going on in the news currently with the petitions to the White House?
Yeah, I think the petition, the power there is to raise awareness. I think with the 1850 fugitive slave law, which was probably the forerunner to the Civil War, which really gave impetus to the starting of the Civil War,
mm-hmm.
the outrage of abolitionists, particularly black abolitionists, and the meetings and the defiance. I was surprised at the defiance where black abolitionists were taking up arms.
Prior to 1850, did you take note? Prior to 1850, the black abolitionists were confronting the kidnappers, the bounty hunters, people
like
David Ruggles. And I think this is what prompted them to revise the Fugitive Slave Law in 1850, which I had never heard of before. So I thought that was quite interesting. They named a number of cases in Philadelphia, New York, where blacks were just snatching, the free blacks away from the kidnappers by force.
Yeah, and it started a great exodus that I wasn't aware of either, of
mm-hmm.
blacks leaving the various states and headed for Canada.
After 1850.
Yeah, that was after 1850, or right at
1850. And what did you think about Ellen Craft, in which I have posted on Facebook right now, the story of her and her husband, how they dared to return back to slavery and they carried weapons?
Exactly. I made a note on that, on the Crafts arming themselves to resist capture and removal back to slavery.
And, can I make this comment?
Yes. Please join in. The lines are open. If anyone wants to join in, just join in.
Okay, well, I have this observation I wanted to share.
Go right ahead, sir.
In the early 1800s, this movement, Progress, in Quarles' book, he shares that from 1817 to the 1840s, you see a progression and a sharpening of the debate and this discourse on the subject of slavery. But more importantly, you see a sharpening of the discussion on how to resolve it. The role of force comes out in his book. There are two wings, what I call two different lines struggling here. The movement would popularize that slavery should end, but there were those reformists who thought that it, and articulated the idea that it could end probably some kind of way without force. And you see what's happening, that it could only be resolved by the use of force. Which I think is, in my opinion, is the most powerful political lesson coming out of this struggle.
Is this Leon, the historian?
Yes. Yeah, my name is Leon Waters. That idea is not sharply presented, but it is presented. It's presented by the descriptions of the powerful actions that are stimulating the struggle over a period of years, the Nat Turner rebellion, the propaganda pamphlet by Howland Garnett, etc. Now, you had a number of Anglo-Americans that sided with this more militant, direct action, revolutionary, radical posture. For people like William Lloyd Garrison, that would be the splitting question. That led to a separation between he and Frederick Douglass. And all my point is this. You see the same thing being played out today. There's this illusion and there's this deception that some kind of way
all the criminal activities, the oppression of our people, which is on the rise, the assaults against us on every level, privatization of education, police murders, police terror, illegal drug capture, you name it.
Stand your ground.
There's this illusion that these things can be solved through negotiating, debate, discussion. That's, and you see the form it takes. This group called Change.org and the numerous other groups that they want you to sign a petition, okay, to voice your opposition on that. The signing the petition is not the point I'm trying to say. The point I'm trying to say is that they limit the struggle, and in so doing, they give the illusion that we can solve this problem. If Change.org and all these other type of online petitions things had the understanding that, yes, we want you to change, we want you to sign this petition, and the petition says so and so, but along with that, we want to bring an end to the existing order that's oppressing us. We say there has to be a much more powerful revolutionary idea connected with the reform that they're fighting with. Because they don't make that connection, they end up actually miseducating people of the goal and aim of the fight. We cannot transform the society without the replacing of this system with another system. And one of the most powerful things to learn from history, which I think some of these teachers and educators, in particular university professors, fail to teach, is that is the political lesson. They could not have reformed chattel slavery where it would have been eliminated. Recently, intellectual conversation that was on TV, you had it was like a round table discussion. You had about four different people there, and two Anglo Americans, no, three Anglo Americans, and one African American. And one of the African Americans there was the head of the
earth. Leon, here recently, there was a successful petition. At least the TV network was successfully lobbied to cancel a show about a rapper's reality show about baby mama drama and his 11 children. So that is the power of petitioning, if you will.
I'm not saying that in itself is wrong. Don't get me wrong. I'm saying. And that's a game. That's great. That's a game. But what I'm saying is, in my opinion, it can't stay at that level where we don't connect the reform we're trying to get with the need to, with the ultimate demand that should be linked to. Let me just say this, and I'll shut up. At this round table, for instance, the president of the League makes a statement, because they were talking about economics and low income and minimum wage. He says, the way we see change to come about to improve the well-being of the poor and people is that the economic system we live under has to be reformed. Now, he didn't lay out how he sees that can be done. But frankly, that is impossible. And see, you're giving a reformist solution that cannot be made, cannot happen under the existing order. Why can't? Because, he really should try to explain himself. But why can't? Because the economy is in the hands of the wealthy, not the government. Can you really sit down with the people who control the economy and negotiate with them to make it better, make it more balanced for people? That's impossible. Or can you appeal to the government
to get the government to get them right. When the government, if you check out Congress lately, when the government is all a bunch of millionaires themselves. So it's this kind of unscientific ideas that they disseminate amongst masses that make them think that waging a reformist campaign alone will lead to necessary fundamental change. It will not. It did not under chattel slavery, and it's certainly not going to do it under the existing law. That's my comment.
Okay. Very good. Thank you for joining us, Leon. Mr. Leon Waters, a historian, giving us some comments and his take on the reading of The Black Abolitionist by Benjamin Quarles. So are we to say that blacks should stay as far away from money and trading with non-blacks? That blacks should stay away from trading money and trading with non-blacks.
I'm not sure of what the question is.
Okay. But mine are callers. That the call-in number is 347-324-5552. Just completed a reading of The Black Abolitionist by Benjamin Quarles. Excuse me. We've been talking here just recently with Mr. Leon Waters, historian, in reference. Is that a caller? Okay. On the power of petitions.
I have a question.
Sure.
Leon, do you think that the financial system is our answer? The economics?
Do I think what?
How do we get out of this rut? Through the economy? Through finance? Is that what you're alluding to?
Oh, no. It's going to take a revolution to get out of this. We got to replace this system with another system. We got to replace the existing state apparatus with another state apparatus. There's not going to be any other way. We can't go through a reformist movement to correct what exists because the depth of the oppression that we're under is so entrenched, it cannot be reformed. Now, we can get some, there's struggle all over the country. And some of them are making some steps, some gains, just like this example the gentleman just said. And all that's great, I mean, because you need these victories to increase your fighting capacity. But what I'm saying is, and I may not be saying it clear enough, it might be my fault, what I'm saying is all these struggles really should be connected with the ultimate aim. And what do I mean by that? Well, if you're picketing somewhere and you're trying to get some justice or you're trying to get an increase on wage or what have you, whatever the immediate objective, the immediate reform is, on your signs, you should also connect that with, hey, we want the dictatorship of the rich, for instance, brought down. And that's a revolutionary idea. You have on one side of your picket sign, raise the wages 25%, let's say. On the other side, you have on your picket sign to stop police brutality or whatever it is. Then on the other side, your sign, you have something like make the rich pay, or down with the dictatorship of the rich. That idea is a revolutionary idea. And what that does, along with your reform, it puts more pressure on the class you're fighting. Sometimes you even get concessions just from an inflammatory flyer. But at the same time, you're educating people that, hey, we just can't stop for a reform, which is really a tiny improvement. We've got to understand that we're going to have to build a movement that's going to replace this. Because society doesn't get transformed, well, we're still going to be in a rut. That's all I'm saying.
Well, the present system is capitalism.
Right.
The alternative systems would be socialism, communism, or fascism.
Okay.
We are to have equitable distribution of the wealth.
Okay, all right, okay.
As Mr. Marx said a number of years ago, you have to seize the means of production.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't know that that capability exists right now within the United States. There must be another way to formulate that without going to one of the other known systems, economic systems that exist throughout the world.
Well, you're right. That capability doesn't exist at this time. What I'm saying is that everything in life begins small and grows big. You know, I'm saying that although it doesn't exist, I'm on my opinion that we have to get clear on what is the ultimate solution, and be guided by that. The bill, we have to rebuild the struggle in this country, and I think the political objective has to be replacing the existing order with another order. You can debate, discuss what that should be, but without a doubt, this thing got to go. This thing can't be reformed. It's got to go. I mean, all the most important things, means of production, the publishing houses, means of communications. Sure, we got some freedoms now with the internet, but even the government can shut that down. All that's controlled by a handful of people. And they are so greedy. They are definitely bearing down through their government, through an austerity program that's making our situation worse and worse and worse. And hopefully we can build a serious party of the working class that can really contest for power in this country. Or else we're going to be driven down to the level of what's going on in Italy. These people in D.C. can't unite on anything. They are debating and quarreling among themselves. They represent two wings of the big rich. We have no future with that. So we got to find something else. Find another way. That's all I'm saying. Yes, this is and so the movement has to be rebuilt. And that's all I'm saying. In St. Quarles' book, they're saying, and the point he brings home out of his book, he doesn't expressly say it, but it comes out that it's going to take force to transform society. And take force to do it.
Liam, before we go, last question. There were two types of colonies that came here on different systems, political systems. The religiously persecuted who formed their own colonies and settled here for totally different reasons than the colonies that were settled and chartered by England. What do you have to say about the two different systems, and they weren't out for the same motives as far as finances and capitalism?
Well, I think there were more than two, but one big section of the country was colonized by the English, another section was colonized by the French, another section was colonized by the Spanish. You know, they were all competitors, just like Exxon, Mogul, and BP, all competitors today. They're all oil companies. They're all competitors. You know,
and Pennsylvania was chartered by the Quakers.
Okay, all right.
And you had a few of the first settlers. Were not here based on the king's rules. In fact, they were ostracized and sent here.
Right.
But as they began to develop and become wealthy, they sent other people to compete with the religious people and to push them out with the use of free labor, forced labor, slaves.
Right.
So this country, that's why, during the inception of the country, the abolitionists fought for one type of government, and you had the slavers fighting for a different type.
Right.
I think Thomas Jefferson had some famous quote about which way are we going to go, morally or capitalism. And he said, you have to pick right now. Let's choose.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like we chose capitalism. But do you have any take on the two different systems, and what was the system of the religious persecuted settlers?
I'm not familiar with the what was the economic
mm-hmm.
agitation of the religious persecutors.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
think Vermont,
I don't think it was that different from what we understand at the beginning of capitalism, because my understanding was all this stuff was based off commodity production. Mercantilism was a form of the capitalist development, and then it moved from a lower form to a more higher form to eventually get the form of monopoly capitalism and what have you. Historically, as a trend, it was progressive. What do I mean by that? Okay, well, it was progressive. It moved the world and society forward, coming out of feudalism. Okay, but it would reach a certain point in its development and become no longer progressive. I mean, it was progressive to be able to build a plant where one time you had a man making a shoemaker, and now you have a building with 100 people making shoes. That's more productive, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That is progressive. The problem is that as the economic system developed in its development.
Now, are you familiar with the Quakers in the Dutch country and their way of living?
No, I'm not.
Okay. All right. Well, we have to have another show. We both have to study their system, and they're still in existence right now, Dutch
mm-hmm.
country and PA, and they have a simple life. But I just want to thank you for joining the conversation and like to end the show tonight. Any closing remarks?
Well, my only closing remark I can give you is that I enjoyed the show. I was listening from Penny Marshall on the way to the gentleman. That's a very the gentleman who reads the thing. He reminds
me. Preston Washington.
Yeah. Okay. He reminds me of the gentleman on that Allstate commercial. He speaks very well. Speaks very
mm-hmm.
powerful, and he gives
mm-hmm.
me life to the history. So I enjoy it.
I think his phone died out on us, so I had to take over. But again, thanks again for calling. I hope you continue to support us. And anyone in the Delaware area, come on out this Sunday and do the walk with Penny Marshall and commemorate Harriet Tubman Day in Delaware. Thanks so much.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, bye-bye.